Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning and hello. This is Pastor Fred. We're on Perspectives on the Bible, and we're going to be studying the second section of our programs on the Ten Commandments for today. I hope we'll be able to cover the rest of the commandments. We've covered up to the fourth commandment so far. It's been exciting to do that. I hope we'll have a great program. This is also a call-in program, so if you want to participate in the program, you can call in. We have some rules and regulations on the way we conduct call-ins in this program, but the basic idea is to keep it civil and to, if you want to make a case, and rather than asking questions and casting aspersions. Okay, I'm Pastor Fred. This is Ten Commandments for Today. It's the fourth day of February, the year 2011, and you're listening to Perspectives on the Bible. Let's stop for our theme song, and we'll be right back. Hello, this is Pastor Fred. We're dealing with the Ten Commandments on Perspective on the Bible and with the Fifth Commandment. Just a few notes about what we're doing here. We're using as the source a fine book put out by Erdman Press. I don't know if it's still published. William Barclay, The Timeless Truth for Today's Moral Issues, The Ten Commandments for Today, Gain New Insights into Our Current Problems. I have a paperback copy is quite old. I don't know. Let me just see if I can get to the front here. And I don't want to waste a lot of time looking for it. But it's published copyright 1973, William Barclay, published William B. Erdman's company, 1973. And then reissued again in its fourth printing in 1979, William B. Erdman's company. So, great book. I'm not reading every word, but I'm giving you the idea. And I've talked to you before about this, but I'll just reiterate it. Barclay has a little bit different numbering of the Ten Commandments. They're actually still ten, but he has a little different numbering than Lutherans are used to. We're used to a little complication at the end. He has a very unique approach. I think he does a great job of it. And let me read you the Ten Commandments as he sees them. Number one, you shall have no other gods before or beside me. Number two, you shall not make for yourself a graven image. Number three, you shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain. Number four, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. Number five, honor your father and your mother. Number six, you shall not kill. Number seven, you shall not commit adultery. Number eight, you shall not steal. Number nine, you shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. And number 10, you shall not covet. And the Lutheran change there would be that probably the second one, you shall not make for yourself a graven image, I don't think that appears in most Lutheran catechisms. I think it's included in not taking the name of the Lord your God in vain. That's the difference. As he sees it, we went into details on that in our first program. We're going to go to what he calls the fifth commandment, which is honor your father and your mother. This commandment, he says, is built into the very structure of human society. And I think that's true. We all have a mother, and we all have a father biologically. Let's face it, that's part of the human family. That's how we get along. Unlike fish, perhaps, you know, I used to raise prize guppies, and, you know, the guppies, a live bearing, it delivers a live fish in the water, but, you know, I don't think they have any relationship to the mother, as far as I can tell. And I raised guppies for quite a number of years, same thing with swordtails and mollies. These were all aquarium fish. So in the fish world, I guess that's not so. Now, of course, a whale has a live bearing, and it's a mammal, and it does have a relationship with the calf for a while in the ocean, you know, quite a while, as a matter of fact. And so on. So, you know, we can't make clear biological distinctions about what a father and a mother is, but the idea is that the Old Testament again and again reiterates the command that children are responsible toward their parents and parents are responsible toward their children. Now, I'm not going to go into exactly what Barclay has to say right at this point. I just want to set out some parameters that I think are important in relationship with each other over the years of my ministry at St. Matthew's Lutheran Church in Bergenfield, New Jersey, where I've been the pastor for over 30 years, graduated from Concordia Seminary in St. Louis in 1972, was ordained in 1972, and have been the pastor here since 1973. And let me just put out the parameters of what I think relationships are like in terms of children. The first one is to say that every individual person, this is Fred's principles here, every individual person born belongs to God. So we're saying that everyone who is born is an individual, he's not a group, he's one of a kind, twins or otherwise, Siamese or otherwise, makes no difference, individual people, separate minds, separate souls, separate bodies, even though connected in a Siamese twin situation, still separate. Every individual person belongs to God. Now, the Bible talks in several places in the book of Psalms and also in the book of Jeremiah and elsewhere that God knew us before we were ever born. In other words, he knew us in the womb. Now, we can get into the whole abortion shtick, and I don't want to go there. This isn't the program for it. But I would suggest I happen to be a married man. I have children, three children. I have grandchildren. I've watched the birth process. I've been involved in it myself. And children, you know, do exist pre-birth. I mean, you know, the whole quickening thing. You touch the mother's womb, her tummy, so to speak. You feel the baby moving. They take ultrasounds. You can see the baby sucking. And we can call it a fetus all we want to call it. And people can say, well, it's not really a baby because it can't live outside the mother. Well, let's just go there for a minute. It's not really a baby because it can't live on its own outside the mother. So when, after birth, can a child live on its own without any other human being helping him or her? I would suggest that if you just deliver a child and you do not assist the child to eat and to drink, that every human child born and given no assistance will die. End of story. So the argument that it's not really a baby because it can't live apart from its mother or its father or other human existence means, if you carry that logic to its conclusion, if we accept the idea that the baby in utero is a fetus, and the definition of a fetus is a being that cannot exist outside its mother, without its mother, cannot exist outside its mother, then we would have to carry that conclusion to say at what point would a child be able to live. Now, first off, we'd have to say that a child born outside its mother and severed from it has to be severed because the afterbirth will be severed of itself. You know, it's delivered all by itself. The placenta separates from the body. The child is now on its own, can breathe on its own and all that. But without further human assistance from any other human person. The child cannot reach a point, cannot attain to a point whereby the child will be able to sustain itself, because the child, without any human assistance ex utero, will die. End of story. So that's a facile argument, to say the least. And let's hypothetically say that somehow, by a miraculous evolutionary process, which is absurd, but anyway, by some miraculous evolutionary process, a baby born, now ex utero, separated from the mother, was able to survive. Now, when would that child, from what we can see of normal human development, be able to take care of itself? That means get food. Now, I'm not saying processed food or go to Safeway or go to Kroger's. I'm talking about taking care of itself, be able to feed itself. That is, get food, and without assistance from any other human person. Never, because the child would have to live without assistance from any human person in the first place, past a couple of days when it would certainly die, since it had no assistance from any other human person. It's called exposure. We expose children in China, even to this day, so that they will die. Even in India, they're exposed and just put on the wayside into the woods and left there to die, because they cannot take care of themselves. That's called exposure, or some kind of killing. We regard that as killing. But let's say 1 year old, no, 2 years old, 4 years, five. Well, if the child ever got to be 5 years old, which of course you and I see immediately is absurd, without any other human being giving him assistance, then the child at 5 years old would have to be able to plant, would have to be able to grow, would have to be able to harvest. So now we have to get, maybe before the child could ever understand and do those things all by himself, without any other community existence whatsoever, that child would remain a fetus by that definition, that a fetus is a child or a baby or a thing inside the mother's womb that cannot exist outside the mother. Therefore, we can abort the fetus. You see that whole fetus thing. So if that's the definition of a fetus, a child who cannot live without motherly assistance, the child would have to get to be about 10 years old before we would stop calling it a fetus. Now, does that mean that we can kill the child at age 2, age 4, age 6, if we decide that the child is not viable at age 6? You see, the absurdity of these arguments, and I'm carrying the argument to absurdity, because I think that's the proof of arguments. You carry them to absurdity to see if they hold water, as it's, or does the bucket have a gigantic hole in it? In this case, it does. It doesn't carry water. It's worthless. It's a worthless argument, that the definition of a person is that. So, okay, now, the first principle that I'm putting out there is that every individual human person born belongs to him or her, belongs to God, number one. Secondly, the second principle, second Fred's principle, is that every single individual human person belongs to him or herself. They don't belong to anyone. They belong to God, and they belong to themselves. So, okay, where do parents come in? Parents are given the privilege, that's what I call it, number three, of having children. Number four, parents are responsible to and accountable for their children. Responsible, they have to respond to their children. They respond. They act toward their children. They are responsible to their children and accountable for their children. And that means that we, other people, can hold them accountable for their actions over against their children, because they had the children. And they have a responsibility to the child, a live child, born live. They have a responsibility to that child to take care of it. That is their human responsibility. That's the nature of things. We are not fish. We're just not. You know, that's the way it is. And so those are the principles that I would start with. In terms of human community, we need each other, and we have a responsibility toward each other and accountability for each other. We're going to continue on with this a little bit, extended discussion of the fifth commandment, honor your father and your mother, after a little pause. Stay with us.
Thank you.
have one vision. Hello, this is Pastor Fred. We're back to Perspectives on the Bible, Ten Commandments for today. This is the second broadcast. We're dealing with the Fifth Commandment, and we're looking at William Barclay's book, The Ten Commandments for Today, Erdman's Press, 1979. And I've just enunciated some principles about children, personal life, what children are, and the responsibilities of parents to children and children to parents. Basically, I'm not going to go into too much of what Barclay goes into, quite an extended piece here. He does a wonderful job about a Roman society, Greek society, how they regarded children and parents, a Jewish society, how they regarded Jewish and parents, and the responsibility to and accountability for children. I think that a very important part of the whole idea is to say that parents, you know, have this great, wonderful privilege, and I'm trying to talk to it in a modern context. When you have children, and we have the ability today to prevent having children, we can use condoms, we can use birth control, or we can use abstinence. One method versus another method. I don't really think there's terribly much argument about that. There may be, you know, you can get into the finer points of theology and philosophy and ethics, but we know how to prevent having children, which the minimum is to control yourself. That's abstinence. And then there's other methods. Okay, so when you do have a child, if that's a decision, or if it's a slippage, it's a mistake, it's an error, you were irresponsible and you had a child, then you have this human being that's born to you, and the child belongs to God, the child belongs to himself or herself, and then you have responsibility toward and accountability for the child. And that means raising the child in the Christian ethic. It means raising the child in the fear and awe of the Lord, to be awesome, to be in relationship to God. And that relates to us in terms of baptism. We bring the child in to the church to be baptized in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit with water, in order that the child can become part of the community of the Christian church, be part of the body of Christ, which is the church, be in relationship to Jesus. Now, this baptism is a commitment on our part when we bring the child, who cannot at this point do that for themselves, that we, the parents, will see to it as our responsibility to and accountability for, we will see to it that the child is raised up in the Holy Christian Church. That means we will teach the child his or her prayers. We will provide for the child's Christian instruction. We will bring the child to the services of God's house. We will make sure that the child is diligent in participation in the community of the Christian faith. We will provide for their reception of Holy Communion at the appropriate time according to the different denominational traditions within Christianity. And we will always pray for our child to have the encounter with the Lord Jesus Christ in the Holy Spirit. Now, that Holy Spirit comes to the child, we believe as Lutherans, in holy baptism. The child, no child gains baptism by any works. It's not something you gain, not something you work for, not something you buy. Baptism is, and the reception of the Holy Spirit in baptism is an act of unmerited graciousness on God's part without any worthiness in us. Now, that being said, then we have those responsibilities toward the parent. The parent also can expect responsibilities from the child. The child must be responsive to the parents, which is to say, have his proper place with the family, understand that the parents are bigger and smarter and older and more experienced, and they are the providers of protection and food and sustenance, education and wisdom. The child should know that and should therefore honor the parents for those factors. The parent, in turn, has an obligation to raise the child up in wisdom and knowledge and the way of the Lord. And we have plenty of evidences in the book of Deuteronomy and elsewhere in the scriptures about that. But let's just deal with our Lord Jesus himself and the famous episode that we've just gone through in terms of Jesus. We have Mary, the mother of Jesus, who carries the baby Jesus in her womb. She knows this is of the Holy Spirit. She's very surprised about this baby, but she takes care of the baby, and she doesn't abort the baby. She provides for his protection. She protects the baby. And she is given assistance by Joseph, who, even though this is not his own child, and he knows it, he's received messages in prayer and in dreams, visions, that this child is of God, and therefore Joseph takes up his responsibility to an infant, a child, and his accountability for that child by being Mary's husband, and he provides protection. When the child is born and they learn that the child is in danger because the child will be killed by Herod, they flee. Mary and Joseph leave their native land. They go to another place, and they take with them the gold and frankincense and myrrh with them to pay their way, as it were, over there in Egypt, where they flee. And also, Joseph is a carpenter, so he can apply his trade there in Egypt, making plows and the like more for local farmers and things that are necessary, so that he can sell those goods in Egypt and provide for the sustenance, protection, and welfare of his son. Because although he's not legally the father, he, as it were, adopts Jesus. So they live out the commandment very well. Mary does and Joseph does. And then when we get to the 12th chapter, and notice also, by the way, before all this happens, they present the child at the temple. The presentation of Jesus in the temple, which is recorded to us in the book of Luke, is the story of how they recognize that this child, as all children are, belongs to God and must be redeemed by being presented at the temple and the appropriate sacrifice offered to God to purchase or redeem the child to themselves from God, which is the symbolic representation of the principle that all human life belongs to the creator of life, namely God himself. When they are in Egypt, they return from Egypt, they raise the child up in Nazareth, and it says, we hear in the book of Luke, that they travel back and forth to Jerusalem regularly for the Passover and other festivals, and the child is raised up in the faith. And we get to that marvelous episode of Jesus around age 12 or 13, Jesus in the temple, which is probably his bar mitzvah or something along those lines, and we understand that Jesus is now coming into his own already. But after bringing that story to its end, when we come to the end of that story, it says, and Jesus went down with Mary and Joseph and was obedient to them and grew in wisdom and stature and with peace and grace with all men. So this evidence of the affirmation by Jesus, you know, this is the Son of God, the Savior of the world, the second person of the Holy Trinity, who submits to family life and is obedient to his mother and his father. In Jesus' case, he carries that to the extent of being obedient to his mother and his father for 30 years. He is, as a matter of fact, I would suggest that Jesus is always fulfilling the fourth commandment, fifth commandment here, honor your father and your mother, even to the point of the cross where Jesus says, you know, Mary, looking at his disciple John, Jesus says to John, behold your mother, pointing to Mary, his mother, and to Mary he says, mother, behold your son. And there's a lot of interpretations of that, but at the very primary level, are the dying Jesus the eldest son if he has brothers and sisters, or the only son if he's the only child, is providing the legalities for his mother, who would have to be taken care of. And this, in his last will and testament, he makes sure that Mary, his mother, is provided for with protection, with sustenance, with housing and the like more, and care in the community, and is not left outside of the community as being the widow of Joseph and now the mournful mother of an only son or of an eldest son who never provided for her. Rather, Jesus carrying out the fifth commandment, honor your father and mother, carries it down to his dying breath. That's how important Jesus regards obedience to the commandments, and it's a very good example for us as well. Let's take a pause here. If you want to call in and talk about this topic, the number for you is 1-347, I think that's a long-distance call, 1-347-215-9968, 1-347-215-9968, and if you want to come into the chat room, just send a little message, and we'll see if we can pick it up there through the chat room. That would be free. Let's take a little pause here for our music, and we'll be right back.
I feel love.
Hello, this is Pastor Fred. We're back at 10 Commandments for today, and we're looking at the 6th commandment. We're going to move on to that. And this is a very interesting treatment, I think, by William Barclay in his book, The 10 Commandments for Today, William Erdman's 1979. I'm looking at a paperback copy of it. I think it might not be published anymore, but if it is, well, I'm not reading the whole book, just pieces of it, and I'm using it as a basis, and I'm giving you plenty of advertisements, so if you want to buy it, go ahead and buy it. I think it's a pretty good book. You can get it out of the library. Okay, we're looking at the 6th commandment, which he says is, you shall not kill, Exodus chapter 20, verse 13. But the modern version in general substitutes murder for killing, and so does Moffat and Goodspeed and the authorized version. The commandment forbids murder specifically and not killing in general. I think that's very, very helpful, especially in today's world where people don't know anything about religion and they know nothing about Christianity, and they have no concept of what we're talking about in the commandments. They just think that we're against killing, and you have these little silly arguments of people coming to us and saying, well, you know, if you're against killing, why do you have war, and why do you have this? We don't want war. I have so many people. I'm a chaplain. I was a chaplain, retired, United States Army, 30 years of service, and I don't like war. I never liked war. I didn't like the last war. I was in 4 years of active duty in Iraq. I wasn't in Iraq for the support of the Iraq war. And the issue was, you know, people said to me, well, you know, now that it's come to war, you have to just throw down the gauntlet and refuse to serve. Well, I never served the war machine in the first place, number one. I don't agree with war. I think war is terribly wasteful. It's the breakdown of diplomacy, as many have said, and communication. So war is just stupid. And besides the killing and all that aspect of it. However, I had 26 years of service. I took the money, and I was going to do the service. Now, what I do, of course, as a chaplain, is I serve soldiers. And some people in this last conflict insisted to me, right to my face, oftentimes quite nastily, at the National Cemetery at Arlington as I was burying soldiers, or elsewhere when I was burying soldiers, that I was guilty of the death of these soldiers because I was condoning murder, and I was condoning warfare, and I was part of the war machine and all that kind of business. Well, I don't agree, and we can go into a big, long discussion about that. My job was to bring God to people and people to God. That's what I did, and I also trained chaplains to do the same so that we could be of assistance spiritually for the souls of men and women who were fighting the battles, whether we agreed with the battle or not, and always acting as a source of peace and a source of reason and a place for the input of reason and peace in the discussions. I was a colonel, and I oftentimes had plenty of opportunity to talk to other colonels who were the decision makers, and oftentimes speaking up to the 2- and 4-star general level on issues of ethics and morals and whether or not we should do A or B or C. And my input was avidly sought by my leadership and by other leadership, and that input was also listened to and sincerely and honestly considered. And oftentimes it did have an impact on certain procedures that we carried out and certain things that we did. It wasn't always perfect. Sometimes we failed, and sometimes the structures of the military failed to interact accordingly and according to ethics and all that good stuff. But we were in there. We weren't sitting on the sidelines casting rocks and spitting out all kinds of ejaculative accusations. We were there in the front lines and with the leadership and with the people who were doing what they were doing, whether or not we agreed. And therefore, we had a stake in it, and that stake was respected, and our voices were heard. And the protesters at the Arlington Cemetery who were coming to the funerals of people that I was burying had no idea of the devastating effect that they were having on other people. This is a family whose child was killed, whose husband was killed, whose father was killed. Whether it's in a war or otherwise, they're experiencing enormous emotional stress and strain and devastation. And to have people show up as Cindy Sheen groups and Pink Hat Ladies or whatever these people were, and to call us the baby killers and all this good stuff, and to chant all kinds of slogans at the parents and even call the parents and say to them, you killed your child because you allowed your child to serve in the military, that's just absurd. And besides that, it's not. Some of them said they were Christians. And they said, we have to do this because we're Christians. Well, I don't think that's the Holy Spirit, and I don't think that's the Christians. I think that's just egotistical, maniacal people who believe that they can do anything they want to do in terms of their murder and their killing and their destruction of human persons because they're right and everybody else is wrong. So, you know, those are always dangerous places to go into, and I don't want to go there. All right, enough on that. Life is sacred, William Barclay says in the Sixth Commandment, which seems to be obvious. He said the Hebrew verb implies that the commandment really means no violent or unauthorized killing. And he goes on to say that Hosea, for instance, says there is no faithfulness or kindness and no knowledge of God in the land. There is swearing, lying, killing, stealing, and committing adultery. They break all bonds and murder follows murder. That's Hosea. Jeremiah hears the condemnation of God to the people, and he says, will you steal? Will you murder, commit adultery, swear falsely, burn incense to Baal, go after other gods that you have not known, and then come back and stand before me in this house, says Jeremiah. Now, William Barclay starts, I think, correctly by saying, there is a sense in which one might say that it is hardly necessary even to state this commandment, because there is obvious sanctity to human life, which is the very nature of things, and which is in the very nature of things, and forbids the violent taking of it. I would agree when he was writing in 1979. I don't necessarily agree that inherent in a society today is the understanding of the sacredness of human life. I think I've talked about this in other programs. I'll just reiterate it again. I think there is a strong degradation of the understanding of the sacredness of human life today, fundamentally based upon the idea that people have that human beings are the result of evolutionary helter-skelter. In other words, if you take evolution seriously and it's being taught at the lowest levels of school, and it applies not only to animals and dinosaurs and all that good stuff, but it applies to human beings. And from that, I would suggest the teaching of evolutionary, quote-unquote, science, and I think it is science. I have no objection to the concepts of evolutionary science, but with it comes evolutionary philosophy, and from evolutionary philosophy, which is a creedal system or a belief system, comes evolutionary theology, if there is any theology at all in evolution, which is debatable. And then from that comes a worldview of the human person, and evolutionary philosophy / theology, anthropology, if you want to call it that, is that the human person is the product of evolutionary mistake. You and I are an error. We are a cosmic hiccup. We are the result of a accidental explosion which creates all the, and we can go on in all the details. But the fundamental concept there, which I find objectionable, is the idea which, you know, the creed, that which you believe, is the father to the deed. The creed is the father to the deed. Evolutionary thinking says that human people are not unique. They're not exceptional. They are merely the highest carnivore on the food chain. We're the most successful murderer on the food chain. We kill others, animals, all kinds of animals, and we slaughter them for our own eating. We are carnivores. And we kill other people for our own pleasure. So, and whatever reasons other people want to give for that, what they say, why we kill other people, murdering other people. So I would say in 1979, before the full effect of this century-long teaching of evolutionary anthropology, which is touted out there in the academic world of colleges, to which we send our children, trusting that our children are getting the best. But you know what they're being taught? Like Woodrow Wilson said, the purpose of college education is to make the student as different from the parent as possible. And that includes the rejection of the parents' value systems and religion. Yeah, you think about Woodrow Wilson for a while. So when you deal with that, then you say today we have all kinds of utilitarian viewpoints about the human person. If we use Skinner, with Skinnerian psychology and the like, we have also the experimental phases, which equates the human person to a rat. We have the Pavlovian response, which equates the human person to Pavlov's dogs. We have the scientists today who are dealing with cloning, who want to say that we're no different and no better than the cloning of a rat or a mouse. And so, you know, why not clone us as well? And there's all the theological and ethical stuff for those who believe in theology and ethics and morality revolving around that. So what I'm trying to get to, and let me get to it more pointedly, is I'm not sure that in a society that wholeheartedly buys into evolutionary anthropology, that there is inherent in their thinking, the evolutionists, that human life is sacred. Now, it might be the best organized life. It might be the highest form of organized life. It might be the highest form of carnivore. It might be the most successful species, but there is no differentiation of a man from a bear or a man from some other things. I just recently watched Brother Bear, the cartoon, wonderful cartoon, great cartoon, loved the cartoon. I think it had a very, very powerful message, and I appreciated the message. There's many layers to that message, anti-violence, anti-killing, anti-murder, anti-wantonness, a lot of environmental stuff, all that kind of stuff, recognize the bear as a person, all that business. But at the end, the author makes this huge leap where the boy has this other animal, this coda, and the boy, who was a human person, becomes a bear. He gets to know this other bear, who was never a human person, and at the end of it, he chooses to be asked, to ask the gods, so to speak, to make him back into a bear, because he doesn't want to be a human anymore. He would rather be a bear and take care of the coda bear. Well, that, you know, it's a large stretch. You know, you're saying, Reverend Fred, you're making a big jump here. No, I'm not. Taken in its context, it's very sweet and very nice and very sentimental and very romantic and very unrealistic. But at the same time, it's also philosophical to say that the boy, who was a human person, believes it's equal to or maybe even better than being a human, that he should be a bear. Now, you can make all kinds of dissembling about that, but you look at it in a certain context and you see that there is no longer in our society the presumption or the assumption that human life is sacred. And so the prohibition against murder is not automatic, although I think it's still there because of Judeo-Christian culture and Judeo-Christian sensitivities and the residual lingering effects of the legacy of Christianity and Judaism. Whether or not that is still can be said that it goes without saying that the taking of human life by murdering it is wrong on the face, I would not automatically say that that's true. Okay, let's take a pause here. We'll just take a little pause, and we'll come back to this discussion of the commandment, you shall not commit murder. Stay with us. Thank you. Welcome back. This is Pastor Fred. We're continuing on with William Barclay's treatment of this commandment, the sixth commandment, you shall not commit murder. And I'm looking there on page 70 of his book, The Ten Commandments for Today, Erdman's Press, 1979. And it talks about here, since man is made in the image of God, then the taking of a man's life is the destruction of the most precious and the most holy thing in the world. This commandment in itself needs no elaboration and no justification, no defense. It carries the eternal validity on its face. When we look at the book of Genesis, I think we're seeing there a little bit of the, of course we see the first murder, which is Cain, who has his offering rejected and does not accept the judgment of God. And we can look at the sections on the archives here. I have quite a number of quite a bit of material put out there on Cain and Abel and on Genesis and on Cain and Abel's relationship with each other and Genesis as a general topic. But Cain, when he becomes disgruntled, when he becomes angry, when he becomes unconsolable, he knows he wants to get back. He wants to lash back. He wants to use his power over against God. But he knows that God cannot be overwhelmed and cannot be overcome. So Cain chooses that which is obviously the most precious thing to God. The most precious thing to God, Cain knows, is the life of a human person. And so when Cain wants to strike back at God, and when he wants to assert his authority over against God, and he wants to proclaim his independence from God, Cain kills that which is most precious to God, namely the life of another human person. He destroys the life of his brother Abel. And when he's confronted with that, he says, well, am I supposed to preserve that life? Am I my brother's keeper? God, you're supposed to preserve that life. You're supposed to take care of that life. You're supposed to prevent me from taking that life. If you can't do that, God, then you're not as powerful as you say you are. There's a whole lot in that story about Cain who strikes at God through killing his brother. Okay, let's go on from there and say the question that Barclay asks on page 70 is, what is the bearing of this commandment on capital punishment? Is the killing of a man ever justified, even in the interest of legitimate punishment and social justice? It will only be fair to begin with the background out of which this commandment arose, which is namely the Jewish practice and the law that was a part of it. He writes then, within the Jewish legal system, it was never even suggested that this commandment forbade what may be called judicial killing. Let me repeat that. Within the Jewish legal system, it was never even suggested that this commandment forbade what may be called judicial killing. In point of fact, the death penalty was exacted for many and varied crimes under Jewish law. And William H. Bennett, in the article on Hebrew crimes and punishments in J. Hastings' Encyclopedia of Religion and Ethics, conveniently lists the Jewish crimes which were regarded as being liable to the death penalty and the particular way in which in each case, the death penalty was carried out, that is known. Now, the capital crimes for which the death penalty was allowed were, and listen to this list, it's quite amazing. Number one, murder. So you could kill a person for committing murder, and that was Exodus chapter 21, verse 12. Child sacrifice, Leviticus chapter 20, verse 2. Manslaughter, Jewish law made special provision for what might be called non-deliberate killing, killing which happened by accident or as a result of a blow or an attack which was not meant to kill. For men involved in this, six cities of refuge were set apart to which they might flee if they killed without intending to kill, that if the killer was not inside one of these cities of refuge, the avenger of blood might take his life. Numbers chapter 35, verse 9 and following. Next, if you kept an ox known to be dangerous and especially if the ox then killed a man, Exodus chapter 21, verse 29. Capital punishment could be imposed for that. Bearing false witness on a capital charge, Deuteronomy chapter 19, verse 18. That could result in the death penalty. Next, kidnapping or stealing a person. If you kidnapped or stole a person, that Exodus 21:16 and Deuteronomy 24:7 indicated the penalty was death. Insult or injury to parents, Exodus 21:15, Leviticus 29, Deuteronomy 21:18. Next, various kinds of sexual immorality, such as incest, which is to be defined as intercourse with your mother, stepmother, half-sister, granddaughter, stepsister, aunt, uncle's wife, daughter-in-law, sister-in-law, stepdaughter, step-stepdaughter, and step-granddaughter, and mother-in-law. Leviticus 18:6, Deuteronomy 27:20. Next, unchastity, Deuteronomy 22:21. Adultery and unnatural vices, Leviticus 18:23. Fornication by a priest's daughter, Leviticus 21:9. Fornication by a betrothed woman, Deuteronomy 22:22. Various religious and ritual offenses also could be. Witchcraft and murder, Exodus 22:18, Leviticus 26. Idolatry, Exodus 22:20. Blasphemy, Leviticus 24:10. False claims to be a prophet, Deuteronomy 13:5. Intrusion of an alien into a sacred place or office, Numbers 1:51. And Sabbath breaking, Exodus 31:14. Now, isn't that quite an amazing number of ways in which the Bible talks that a person can be subject to judicial murder or the capital punishment? Now, Barclay makes a great case here. He gives you the examples of what, he gives you the ways in which a person can be executed. But at the end of page 72, he makes a startling statement, which I think is quite and should be considered. Now, we must go on having shown that capital punishment in no way is forbidden by Jewish law in the Old Testament, with the fact that the Old Testament also makes it next to impossible to carry out the death penalty. The law shows the seriousness with which Judaism regarded sin. The administration of the law shows the great extent of mercy to which Judaism was willing to go in order to save the person. That such a law was apparently so stern in its demands is a law which was astonishingly careful to preserve the rights of even a very guilty man. So this is very important. So yes, on principle, capital punishment was allowed. And they enumerated the various reasons, and there's a great amount of case law in Judaism regarding the various factors concerning what would be eligible to have capital punishment carried out against the person found guilty of the crime. At the same time, Judaism was fastidious in the extreme to make sure that the individual rights of the person were protected. The individual rights of the person were protected. I think we have this indication for us in the New Testament when we look at Jesus and the woman caught in adultery. That's one of my favorite stories, and it has to do with a woman who is found to be guilty of adultery, and she's dragged out into the streets, and she is going to receive the allowed judicial punishment, which is stoning to death. And Jesus comes, and he confronts the people who are going to stone her. Now, the context is, you know, this is not a gigantic city where millions of people live. This is a neighborhood situation. And Jesus looks at them, and he knows the rules. Now, in order for a woman to be found guilty of adultery, she has to be caught in the act of adultery. And she has to know what that's all about. And the people have to see it. So Jesus confronts them and says, well, what did you guys do, hang out at the window and look in? How did you know she was an adulteress? How did you know she had relationships with many men? And basically, Jesus knows that all of them have had relationships with her or with someone else. And when he says, let that person who is without sin cast the first stone, the inference is, let one of you who has not yourself slept with her or someone else who is not your wife, let you cast the first stone. You see? So Jesus is applying the law. Yes, she's guilty of being stoned to death for her crime, which is adultery, or prostitution, actually. But all of the adulterers are going to do the carrying out of the punishment. And so it's being held up to us in the extreme. That's carrying the case ex extremis, or carrying it to the absurd, as it were. Is there any one of you who is not guilty? How can you dare to kill another person because of their guilt? Rather, justice can be served by mercy, and that mercy is brought about by forgiveness and understanding. Now, that caused a lot of confusion in today's world, and I guess a lot of people could comment on that. If you care to, you're welcome to call in 1-347-215-9968, 1-347-215-9968. I'm Pastor Fred, and let's take a little pause here and stay with us. We'll be back. Okay, this is Pastor Fred. We're back. We're looking at this commandment, the sixth commandment, according to William Barclay in his book, The Ten Commandments for Today, New Insights into Current Problems, published in 1979 by Erdman's Press. And we just dealt with the judicial murder. He goes on to talk about euthanasia. These are very hot topics. I don't know if I'm really ready to get onto all these things. I'll just make a few comments about euthanasia. They're difficult. This is a difficult. I will give you an example of my own experience as an orderly in a hospital. When I was in seminary, I worked at Lutheran Hospital in St. Louis, Missouri. I don't want to get them in trouble. Well, I think they closed now. But anyway, there are lots of issues with that, euthanasia. And there, maybe my examples will not exactly fit the academic world's viewpoints, but I can tell you some of the things that I experienced there. And there was a great hospital, and we did everything we possibly could to save human life. But one day, a woman was brought in, happened to be a woman. She was about 98 years old. This is a true story. The poor woman, she was just a fragile little thing, you know. She was just a little waif of a person. And we took her in, of course. We gave her everything we possibly could. And the doctor examined her extensively and so on, and she died at that time. And the nurse who was called in, you know, she said to me, Fred, go get the doctor. And I went down the hallway, and I told the doctor, I said, such and such happened, we think the patient has died. And the doctor said, what is that? I gave him the description of the person. And he said, yes, I'm coming right now. And I went back. Now, this going up the hallway and coming down the hallway probably took about 60 seconds each way. We didn't have the greatest communications. And the doctor did not come right away. It was about another 60 seconds. So we were at 3 minutes. I went back down the hallway, and I said to the doctor, he said, you know, I'm coming. And we went down the hallway again, and the doctor came in. He looked down at the bed. He saw the person. He went and got the chart. And so, anyway, the long and the short of it was, in about 4 minutes' time, the doctor went over, and he felt her pulse. He took her blood pressure. He felt her heart rate, and he pronounced her dead. Now, I was kind of shocked about that because I felt, well, gee, you know, this doctor didn't do anything for her. He didn't resuscitate her. He didn't all these kind of things that we should do and the like more. And I was very accusatory toward him. And I went to him in his little place where they sleep at night. This is the middle of the night, 2 o'clock in the morning. I said, Doc, I got a big problem here. I said, I think you killed that person. He said, well, you know, the person died of their own accord, and I didn't do anything for them to bring them back if I could have. I said, well, why did you do that? He brought me back down. He said, when you get the patient, because I had to take the patients to the morgue. He said, when you take the patients to the morgue, call me and all. So I'm getting the person ready to go to the morgue, and he comes in the room. He says, okay, let's look at this, Fred. He said, now, this woman came in with a whole host of problems. She's 98 years old, and he turned her over very gently and very carefully on her side, and he showed me what looked like a dinosaur on her back. She had gigantic bumps all the way up and down her spinal column, the size of golf balls just popping out up from her sacrum all the way up to her neck. And he said, you know what that is? I said, no, I don't. He says, that's arthritis. This woman has suffered unbelievable pain. He says, I cannot even tell you how long it takes to develop that kind of massive arthritis. He says the pain involved in having that arthritis must have been for her unbelievably excruciating. And so what did you want me to do when she died? You know, now is that euthanasia? I guess so. I guess so. Experience. Okay, experience number two. Person comes into the hospital. She's rolled into the hospital. She's unconscious, a young woman, very young woman. And doctor looks at her. He does everything he can for her. He's doing the best he can. And she also dies. She dies in the room, and I went down the hallway. It's a different doctor, a different time, different place. And the doctor says, okay, he comes in. Same basic procedure. He examines her. He does what he can. He looks for, you know, signs of life. There are none. She's dead. It's only a few minutes, maybe 2-3 minutes. I said, well, you know, she's still warm, Doc. You know, a minute has passed. You know, she's not past brain dead and all that. You know, we can get her. We can save her. She's only in her 29 or 31 years old. Doctor says, come here. Let me show you the chart. The woman had a chart that must have been the size of a telephone book. And he said, you know what this woman has? I said, I don't know what she has. He explained it to me. Basically, she had a very, very rare form of disease which causes her brain cells to disintegrate. Literally, the brain melts in the head. And he says, that is what happened to her. There is no possibility that I could claim her back. What do you expect me to do? Put a paddle to her, put a thing on her face, beat her chest, and crush her ribs in order that I can make believe? He says, she's dead. I was very shocked by that, too. I thought that not enough was done to save her. I just thought that not enough was done to save her. Subsequently to that, when I was in the pastorate, I was in a hospital situation as a pastor, and a woman was there who was in her 50s or so. And in that situation, the patient had a massive heart disease. And I did become intimate with the case. And when I was there, I said, you know, what's the matter? She had a heart attack. I said, okay, fine. And day one, the dear woman was talking to me. And I just happened to notice that there was no drip in her arm and no fluid being given. And I said, gee, you know, are we going to hydrate this lady? Who are you? I said, well, I'm the pastor. Well, you're not a relative. I said, yeah, but this woman has rights. You have to hydrate her. Oh, well, you don't understand. She's dying. I said, my goodness, I don't care if she's 100 years old. She ain't dying. I mean, you might be killing her. Well, what do you mean talking like that? I said, well, I said, you know, isn't the patient have a right to be hydrated? Well, sadly enough, in this particular situation, they did not hydrate her. They said, well, she has kidney failure. And I said, well, yeah, I got that all about kidney failure due to the heart attack and all this kind of good stuff. But I said, you know, how do you know she's going to die? Well, we can't hydrate her because the kidneys will back up and she'll die. It would be very a nasty death. I said, wait a minute. The doctor shows me the urinary bag. He says, look at that brick red urine in there. I said, yeah, well, that's all fine and dandy, but what about hydrating her? Oh, well, this is illegal. You can't kill a person by not hydrating them. Oh, she said, do not resuscitate. I said, well, yeah, do not resuscitate means do not resuscitate. She's not dead. Well, you don't understand. I said, wait a minute. I've been through a couple of these things. So I want the patient to be hydrated. You're not the relative. I said, okay, come with me. We went down to the patient's bed, and I said to the patient, do you want to have water? The patient couldn't respond. The person said, well, you can see the patient. I said, yeah, the person has not had water for 2 days. You are killing them by he said, the patient is a DNA, do not resuscitate, DNR. I said, doctor, if you do not give this patient hydration, I'm going to call a lawyer. Well, you wouldn't do that. You're not a family member. I said, yes, I am. I am an ombudsman for this patient. You must hydrate the person. Well, let me tell you the end of the story. The end of the story is they did hydrate the person. The person revived. The person had crystal clear urine, yellow urine, crystal clear, non-infection urine within 2 days. The person was up and about out of the bed within 2 days, and the person went on to live another 20 years. Well, would that have been euthanasia? Yeah, that would have been murder. I mean, it really is. So what I'm trying to say here is from experience, cases are different. And each individual case has to be taken on its own merits. However, there are certain principles, and one of them is, you know, you do not murder people. It's one thing to say that the woman died and she had massive arthritis and you did not resuscitate her. It's another thing to say that the person died and she had a massive brain disorder which caused her brain to melt and you did not resuscitate her. It's yet another thing to have I don't care, 50 or 95-year-old woman or man or anyone in bed, very much alive, breathing, and all the rest that goes with it, and you, under this rule of do not resuscitate, you think that you can dehydrate them to death. You see what I'm trying to say? So I think there is a lot of room for discussion, and I think we should discuss it. I think we should debate it. And I think we should have rules, though, you know, rules that say this is so. Now, people say to me, well, quality of life. This person has to have quality of life. What does that mean? I'll tell you my own dad, okay? My dad was 93 years, about 93. Well, probably it was more like 92. He had a good life. He lived a good life. Good man, and he was going downhill. We all knew he was going downhill. He was having some problems with memory. He was having some illusions and delusions. I used to visit him. He thought I was the cleaning man, all that kind of stuff. It was very, very difficult. Big, tall guy, you know, 6 foot plus, and a strong sailor-type guy from his youth, and then a hard-working businessman all his life, and now he was, losing it. He was not having, quote-unquote, quality of life. He didn't drive anymore. He wasn't productive anymore. He was just sort of like sitting in his chair and going downhill. And one day, he didn't do well. He started coughing. He had pneumonia, and we had to bring him to the hospital, and he was hacking and so on and so forth. And people started talking around his bedside about, well, we better let him go. We better let him go because he doesn't have any quality of life. And what quality of life does he possibly have? And my dad and I had a good relationship, and I knew he was still, although a little bit delirious, cognizant of being able to talk. So I said to him, Dad, and he sort of, yeah. I said, do you want to die? And he said, hell no. Just like that. Hell no. And everybody stopped. I said, you know, you're all talking about he should die because he should have quality of life. He'll die when God takes him, you know. I mean, I'm not going to kill him. I'm not going to refuse him medication. I'm not going to refuse him sustenance. I'm not going to refuse him water. I'm not going to refuse him food because he's no longer productive. According to you, he doesn't have quality of life. Why perpetuate the inevitable? He's alive, and he doesn't want to die. And even if he did want to die, I wouldn't consent to allow him to be starved or dehydrated to death. Now, if he died, I would probably say, do not resuscitate, because my father would not want to live on a machine. However, if he was to have a temporary condition by which they had to implant a pacemaker into his chest, I would say, go ahead, do it. Do it. Now, if he's going to die, he's going to die. The pacemaker isn't going to keep him alive. He's just going to jolt. You have to know a little bit about medicine. You know, I know a little bit. I'm not a doctor. But the fundamental principle I'm putting out there is murder, you know, and we have to be careful about that. And we talked about the question of euthanasia. Okay, William Barclay goes on from euthanasia to ask the next difficult question. Let me see what he says here. Suicide. What is the Christian attitude towards suicide? He says, in the Bible, euthanasia actually doesn't appear at all, but in the Bible, suicide appears as an event in both testaments. However, he feels there is no definite teaching about suicide. He goes on at page 81 to say, in the Old Testament, there are at least five cases of a man taking his life. Now, I'm going to have a terrible time with some of these names here. When Ahithophel's counsel was rejected, he went off to his own city and set his house in order, and then he hanged himself, and so he died. 2 Samuel chapter 17, verse 23. 2 Samuel chapter 17, verse 23. Ahithophel committed suicide. Also, secondly, Zimri, besieged by Omri at Tirzan, went into the citadel of the king's house and burned the king's house with fire and died. 1 Kings chapter 16, verse 18. Thirdly, Abimelech, when attacking a tower, was fatally injured by a millstone thrown by a woman and ordered his armor bearer to draw his sword and kill him, lest men should say of him that a woman killed him. And so the young man thrust him through, and he died. Okay, Judges chapter 9, verse 54. Samson, in his last tremendous effort, pulled the house down on himself and his captors. That's an interesting one. I never thought of Samson as a suicide, but I guess it was. Judges chapter 16, verse 23. Saul, conquered and wounded by the Philistines, fell upon his sword after his armor-bearer had refused to kill him. 1 Samuel 31, verse 4. And in the New Testament, Judas Iscariot flung the price of betrayal back at the priest and went out and hanged himself. Matthew 27, verses 3 through 5. Very, very interesting. Let me continue on with Barclay here. This is page 81 in his book, which is, again, as I said to you, The Ten Commandments for Today, William Barclay, 1979, Erdman's Press. He said, in early times, suicide was rare because life was precious. But in the latter times, when the Jews were scattered among the Gentiles, the prevailing pessimism entered their soul, and for the first time, the Jewish rabbinic law took cognizance of suicide. The legal proof texts for forbidding it were Genesis 9:5, namely, for your lifeblood I will surely require a reckoning, and Deuteronomy 4, chapter 4, verse 9, only take heed and keep your soul diligently. This command itself, and Job 2, verse 9, where Job, in face of his disasters, indignantly refuses the suggestion to put an end to his own life. It was at this time that a suicide was legally defined as one who purposely destroys himself. And it was probably at this time that it was laid down that a suicide's body should be exposed and left unburied until the evening, and that there should be no mourning for a suicide, and that a suicide's body should be buried out of the line of other graves. The Jewish law forbade suicide, but this was not to say that there were not times when it might be necessary to, let me just turn the page here, to lay down one's life for one's faith. Very, very interesting. Josephus has two incidents which show the two necessities. At the siege of Masada, all hope was gone, and Eleazar urged the garrison to slay their women and kill themselves rather than fall into the hands of the Romans. There is still, he said, the free choice of a noble death. Let our wives die, thus dishonored. Men will testify that we prefer death to slavery. It is death which gives liberty to the soul and permits it to depart free from all calamity. Unenslaved by the foe, let us die as free men, and our children and wives, let us quit this life together. Josephus, Wars of the Jews, in 7.8. The result of this was that a garrison of 960 all killed themselves, except two women and five children. And so the rabbis told of maidens who drowned themselves rather than go captive to a life of shame. To lay down one's life, then, was regarded as a noble thing. But the other side of the question is seen in the incident of, here we go with one of those names again, Jotapata. Jotapata, J-O-T-A-P-A-T-A. In this case, Josephus himself was involved, and he pleaded with the Jews not to commit suicide. He said, "Why sonder such fond companions as soul and body? It is equally cowardly not to wish to die when one ought to do so, and to wish to die when one ought not to. There could be no more arrant coward than the pilot who, for fear of a tempest, sinks his ship before the storm." It's interesting. "Suicide is alike repugnant to the nature which all creatures share, and an act of impiety toward God who created us." That's an end quote. So then, those who die well and nobly win eternal renown, but the darker regions of the netherworld will lie hold upon those who kill themselves. Also, Josephus' War of the Jews, 3.8. So, in the Jewish eyes, suicide itself was a sin, although on occasions it might be right for a man to lay down his life for his faith and his beliefs and his God. In Greek and Roman world, it may be said that there never was any law against suicide. Suicide was never a legal crime. But with the exception of one period in history, suicide was never approved, and it was regarded as a sin against the gods and as an injury to the state. Now, he goes on to say, this is quite interesting, so I'm just going to continue on with this, that there was what might be called heroic suicide, when a man felt that he was involved in some kind of situation in which the demands of honor made life impossible for him. So there was the famous case of Pantites, P-A-N-T-I-T-E-S, Herodotus 7:3. One of the great battles in history was the Battle of Thermopylae, at which the 300 Spartans stood against the 20,000 Persians. They fought until they died where they stood, with the exception of one man who was not killed, Panites. No one blamed him for it, but when he came back home to Sparta, he was so haunted with shame that he too had not died, that he then killed himself. There was what might be called the romantic suicide, when a person took his own life because he could not live without some dear one who had died. "Err now for human love," says Plato, "for dead wife, for dead son, many a man has gone willingly to the house of Hades, drawn by the hope that in the world beyond they might see and be with those with whom they loved." Very interesting. There was also what might be called the pessimistic suicide, the suicide in which those who felt that death was better than life, and they were many, and who felt it so much that they would rather kill themselves. Now, the Greeks understood, Barclay goes on, these reasons for suicide, as we still do, because such feelings are universal. But the Greeks felt certain things about suicide. He goes on to say, they felt that suicide was a crime against the state. Aristotle is very definite about this. The suicide commits injustice, but against whom? It seems to be against the state rather than against himself. That is why the state exacts a penalty, Aristotle said, because suicide is punished by certain marks of dishonor as being an offense against the state. Now, we have already, Barclay continues, we have already said that suicide was never illegal in Greece, and the marks of dishonor were religious rather than legal. It is the religious wrongness of suicide that Plato stresses by saying, quote, and what shall he suffer who slays him of all men, as they say, is his own best friend? I mean himself. I mean to say the suicide who deprives himself by violence of his own appointed share of life, not because the law of the state requires him, nor yet under the compulsion of some painful and inevitable fortune which has come upon him, nor because he has to suffer from irremediable and intolerable shame, but from sloth or want of manliness, imposes upon himself an unjust penalty. For him, what ceremonies ought there to be of purification and burial? Only God knows. So the suicide was buried in a special place, and the right hand which had done the deed was buried apart from the rest of the body. Quite interesting there. And we could go on from that. Let's take a little pause here. Let's go on. Only at one time and in one group could suicide ever be said to be common and approved, and that was in the Roman Empire in a time contemporary with the early church. It was the time of capricious, tyrannical emperors. It was the time of ambitious and treacherous informers. It was the time when no man's good name, no man's life, and no man's fortune was safe. It was at this time that many took the way of suicide as the way out of what they regarded as an intolerable situation. God gave men life, they said, but God gave men the still greater gift of taking their own lives away. The foulest death, said Seneca, is preferable to the cleanest slavery. Suicide, as it has been put, was the one refuge from tyranny when the lancelet so often offered the way to eternal freedom. When Anestheses was ill and in pain, Diogenes came to visit him. Who will release me from these pains, said Aristides. This, said Diogenes, handing him the dagger. This was the easier because Stoicism was the dominant philosophy, and to the Stoic, life was something that was indifferent. In itself, it was neither good nor bad, neither a boon nor a blessing. In certain circumstances, it could be kept, and in certain circumstances, it could be laid down. But in itself, life had no special value. Quote, they tell us that the wise man will for reasonable cause make his own exit from life, and on his country's behalf, or for the sake of his friends, or if he suffer intolerable pain, mutilation, or incurable disease. Diogenes, chapter 7, verse 1. Seneca says that so long as life is tolerable, he will continue to live it. But if he is afflicted with an incurable and painful disease, or if age shatters his mind, he will go. He writes, he who dies just because he is in pain is a weakling and a coward, but he who lives merely to be brave out of the pain is a fool. But although the Stoics regarded life as something quite indifferent, to be kept or left as a necessity demanded, they did not lightly contemplate their exit from it. When someone suggested leaving life, Epictetus wrote, wait for God, sirs. When he gives the signal and sets you free from your service, you shall depart to him. For the present, endure to live in the place where he has stationed you. Wait, do not depart unreasonably. Epictetus Discourses 1:9. The Stoic would go, but only when he felt justified in going, and never in any case would he be a deserter. The difference between the Greek and the Christian is that the Christian would never justify suicide. Augustine forbade it on two grounds in the City of God. First, it is a step which, in the very nature of things, precludes repentance. Second, it is murder, being a breach of this sixth commandment. Thomas Aquinas forbade suicide on three grounds. First, it is unnatural. Second, as Plato had already said, it is a crime against the community. And third, it is a usurpation of the prerogative of God, who alone has the right to bring life to an end. Kant condemns suicide on the grounds that it is an insult to humanity as embodied in oneself. When we sum all this up, Barclay says, certain things emerge. Isn't this quite exciting? A great book. You should get it if you can. William Barclay, The Ten Commandments for Today, 1979, Erdman's Press. When we sum all this up, certain things emerge. We may well say that suicide always occurs when a man is of unsound mind. H.J. Rose, in an article on suicide in the Encyclopedia of Religion and Ethics, Volume 12, page 22, drops a remark almost in the passing, saying, quote, "It is questionable whether anyone whose life is of normal length is absolutely sane during every waking moment of it." Interesting. And in suicide, a man is, it may well be, always over the edge. For as Schopenhauer saw, suicide is the loss of the will to live. And the suicide is the denial that self-preservation is the first law of life. No one who commits suicide is in that moment of normal mind. Secondly, the fault in suicide is twofold. It involves a running away from life, and it involves, as Thomas Aquinas saw, the usurpation of that which belonged to God alone. In that act, man tries to escape from life by taking the time and season of life into his own hands. Thirdly, if there is one place where condemnation should be, let me just turn the page here, condemnation should be silent, and where sympathy should be paramount, and where self-condemnation should be in the heart, it is here. The man who commits suicide does so because he finds life intolerable, and it may be that it often is the case that this is so because no one helped to make it tolerable. It might well be true to say that there would be no suicides if there had been people to whom the person intent on suicide could have enfolded his mind and heart. And when people are defeated by life, then we may leave them with trust to the mercy of God. For the Christian, the taking of one's own life is forbidden, but we must regard with nothing but loving sympathy the person who in their loneliness and lostness seeks this final escape from life. And he goes on from there. I'm not going to be able to continue with it, but it's quite an exciting one. So if you can get this book out of the library, I think you'll have quite a bit of discussion in your Bible study or in your home or at the dinner table about suicide. Quite interesting. I hope you enjoyed that reading. I certainly did. I'm going to read it some more. But let's take a break here, and I'll be back. This is Pastor Fred. We're listening to The Ten Commandments for today, a consideration of William Barclay's The Ten Commandments for Today, Erdman's Press, 1979.
Into your hands, I commit again with all my. For you, Lord.
Hello, this is Pastor Fred back with the Ten Commandments for today. I don't mean to be talking so fast. I'm running out of time here. So I'm just going to take a little time to make some commentary on the suicide thing. Again, I'll use experience. In the military, I experienced a lot of work with suicides. And as a chaplain, our task was to give seminars to try to prevent suicide classes. To try to prevent suicide, we were the suicide prevention officers. We were oftentimes called in to do counseling with potential suicides and the like. The one comment that the Barclay makes that I wholeheartedly agree with is that I don't think there should be any mean-spirited condemnation of suicide. However, because suicide is such an extreme act, it's such a violent act, and it's violence against itself, and I agree that I do not believe that anyone in their right mind commits suicide. They are obviously insane at the time they commit suicide. However, I don't think we can condone suicide. You see, people in many of my instances, they say, Reverend, what do you think about that? And I say, it's wrong to commit suicide. To commit suicide is wrong. It's morally wrong. You're committing a sin. Now, some people would say to me, well, yeah, but God is forgiving. And, you know, I know it's a little bit odd, but I did use the argument of St. Augustine. When does the person who commits suicide accomplish the murder? Well, you know, if you stab yourself in the arm and you don't die, you stab yourself in the arm, and you maybe mutilated yourself, but you didn't commit murder. If you stab yourself in the chest and you don't die, you may have attempted to kill yourself, but you didn't die, you didn't commit murder. The only time that you've accomplished the act of murdering yourself is when you've accomplished it. So you have to die. So now we have to shift the scene. A person who is alive, although attempting to die and it survives, has not done anything. They've attempted to end their lives. And there's, you know, other than the fact that they've mutilated themselves or something like that, what is there to ask forgiveness about, in a sense? You understand what I'm saying? They haven't done anything. But if a person commits murder, the person dies. And when they die, there's you can't undo that. You can't say, I'm sorry, I almost killed myself. I'm sorry I stole the bread. I'm sorry that I robbed the bank. I'm sorry that I committed adultery. I'm sorry that I insulted my parents. I'm sorry that I, whatever I might have done. You've done a murder, and now you have to face the judgment. That's the problem of that. Now, that's sort of a difficult argument. People don't accept that. But how are you going to repent of something that you don't do until you've accomplished it, and once you've accomplished it, you're dead? That's Augustine's argument. I think it's quite a good argument, as a matter of fact. That's not to say that you want to condemn, in a mean-spiritedness, people who commit suicide. We've read a lot of what William Barclay has to say about suicide, and I would suggest to you that, you know, there's a lot there to deal with. So if you want to get it out at the library, William Barclay's The Ten Commandments for Today, Erdman's Press, 1979, please do. A great discussion. He does quite a bit of great stuff for Bible studies if you're interested in dealing with that stuff, or on your own blog talk radio programs if you care to piece it down into its various parts. It could be quite a great discussion. However, I think that we have to be proactive in suicide. Now, the first thing I want to say about suicide is if you know of anyone who has ever thought of committing suicide, take it seriously. If you know of anyone who has ever thought of committing suicide, take it seriously. thinking about suicide is a very serious matter. Secondly, if you can speak to a person or who you know is contemplating suicide, ask them the key question, do they want to die? Now, a somewhat still healthy person, you know, maybe everyone, I don't know if everyone does, but I guess a lot of people suffer depression, frustration, disappointment, disillusionment, and they may consider whether life is worth living. And when they do that, you know, they may contemplate what it would be like to end their life. And then you have to say, well, do you want to die? Ask that question of yourself or others that you know. Now, if the person says yes, take that very seriously. Take that very seriously. If you ask a person, do you want to die? And not flippantly, but honestly, a person says, yes, I want to die. Take that very seriously. That is a matter for medical, immediate medical attention. And the answer to that question is we need to seek medical advice. We need to seek a doctor. You see, because such feelings could be the evidence of massive depression. And that depression, unrecognized and untreated, can lead to an imbalance of mental state, leading to a person committing suicide against themselves, killing themselves. So please, whenever you hear of a person or know a person who you think is possibly suicidal, and you talk to them and the like more, and you say, do you want to die? And the person responds in a positive sense, then please take that very seriously. And do not, please do not think that you can talk a person out of suicide. That is something that's down the pike. The initial response to a person who contemplates suicide is to seek medical attention and to get medication to treat their obvious depression and to put them into a medical system which will treat them. Now, I'm not saying there's going to be 100% success, because there isn't, but there's remarkable success with potential suicides when they receive appropriate medications to control those feelings of depression which are beyond talking. You can't talk them out of depression, and you can't talk them out of suicide. So don't even try. Be their friend. Get them to a doctor. Go with them to a doctor and tell the doctor the situation and try to get the appropriate medication and see to it that the person takes that medication for their suicidal thoughts. Now, having gone that far, you might have a situation where a person is still considering suicide. And the next question, other than, do you want to die? The person says yes. And you ask the question, if you feel that you're at that stage, how would you kill yourself? If the person you're speaking with has a plan, take that extremely seriously. Even if they say, oh, a gun or a knife. Because the next question would be, well, do you have a knife? Do you have a gun? Yes. I have a gun, or no, I don't have a gun, or I would do it this way or that way. When a person has moved on beyond just fantasizing about ending their life and considering and resolved that they would take their own life, and then has an actual plan, you know, a method to do it, that is a very, very serious, and such a person most likely should be hospitalized. You cannot talk the person out of it. You cannot Bible quote them out of it. You can't use proof texts about it. You can't preach them out of it. You can't do anything. A person in that state needs immediate medical attention. They should be admitted to a hospital. They should have a doctor give them the appropriate medication, because they're suffering from a state of mental depression so great that they may act against their own self-interest while in a state of mental instability. And you, as their friend, should and must seek appropriate medical. Take them to a doctor. Don't just say, go to a doctor, go to a doctor, go to a doctor. I will go to the doctor with you. Take them by the hand. Make the appointment. Pick them up in the car. And the faster, the better. And while you're waiting for that appointment to come, tell the doctor, you know, this is a suicidal situation. I'm their friend. and I love them, and I want to tell you, doctor, this person is contemplating suicide and has said that they want to die, they have a plan, and they know how they would do it. They have the weapon involved. And the doctor, if he's any kind of a doctor or she's any kind of a doctor, will see him or her immediately. And if not, go to another doctor. Get medical attention. Even take them to an emergency room or a hospital. You can do that. And do that. Just say, go with them. Sit down with them. And what is the admitting diagnosis? This person has stated that they want to die. They want to commit suicide. They have a plan. And they know how they're going to accomplish it. And they will be seen by appropriate medical personnel. That is a requirement of the law. So do your friend a favor. If you know that, get them the appropriate medical. The beginning of the healing of suicide is the appropriate medical attention and the appropriate medications, because suicide is more likely a result of depression than anything else. The depression, of course, that a person cannot be talked out of and has no control over. So you're doing that person an enormous deed. Now, after you've done that and intervened as a friend, then you need to keep up your relationship with the potential suicide person. Talk to them. Visit them. If they get admitted to the hospital, don't just leave them there. Go and see them and listen. The very biggest point is to listen. What are they feeling? What are they thinking? And, you know, once a person has contemplated suicide, planned a suicide, has the weapon for suicide, just because they received the appropriate medication doesn't mean that they will not stop taking that medication and carry out the deed anyway. I've been involved in situations where people, one person in particular I'm thinking of, 15 years of medical intervention, 15 years of friendship, 15 years of counseling, and I'm sad to say that this person went away on a vacation. I thought it was going to work out fine. They went away on a vacation, and while on vacation, they stopped taking the medication. They set up the scene in their vacation hotel room, and little known to me, they had gone out and gotten the right equipment that they needed to commit the deed, and they killed themselves in their hotel room. You know, you only need a rope. Yeah, that was 15 years. Well, maybe they had 15 years of life, but maybe that was 15 years of agonizing life. However, we did all that we could to help the person not to kill themselves. So stay in there, hang in there, and more people are delivered from suicide than you know every year. There are lots of suicides every year. Now, people say, well, what ages of suicide? I didn't mean to get into a whole suicide thing, but it's important. What ages? Every age. Young children. Do not think that young children do not think of suicide. They do. They do. And they commit suicide. Yes, young children under the age of 10 commit suicide. It's a terrible, terrible thing. Now, again, it's a very important thing that we take that seriously. If you know the behavior pattern of your child is changing, if their eating habits are changing, if their demeanor is darkening, if they're absenting themselves from interaction, if they're keeping themselves in their room, if they're hiding out, if they're burying themselves in all kinds of dark thinking and dark attitudes and dark punk rock and all this kind of craziness, artwork that's very dark in nature and ugly and nasty, if they're becoming lethargic in their attitudes, lethargic in their schoolwork, and all these deviant behaviors, take that very seriously on the part of children, because children do get depressed and they do commit suicide. So don't forget what I said in the beginning. Every individual human person is a human person, and they deserve to be respected as a human person. They belong to God. They belong to each other. I belong to themselves, and then we, as their responsible adults, parents or others, have a responsibility toward and accountability for those entrusted to our care. Teenagers, huge amounts of problems with teenagers. I think we take them a little bit too lightly, but we recently have heard about the new problem, which is Facebook, and I'm not against Facebook, Twitter, all that kind of stuff, but we know that there are ways in which the social networking system is used to abuse children by other children. and all kinds of social pressures and nastiness occurs, which makes the child an outcast, throws the child outside of their peer group, creates a downward spiral at school and in the streets and in the society, and producing a reclusive child who, again, enters into depression. The depression enters into hopelessness, and a terrible, terrible thing. A teenage child commits suicide. Terrible thing. We take that seriously. Then, you know, change of life changes oftentimes are catalysts for suicide, especially the age group in the 40s, between 38 and 45. This is another very high-risk group for potential suicide because of life changes. Things have gone south, marriages have gone awry, people have lost relationship with each other, divorces have happened, a loss of job, loss of self-esteem, leads to a downward spiral. The downward spiral leads to absence and exclusionary behavior and reclusiveness and further depression, disillusionment, disappointment, and eventually depression, and then, you know, it just goes down and suicide occurs. So please take that seriously if you think that's possible. And lastly, and not least, is elderly people. Elderly people are very prone to suicide because, you know, they lost their loved ones, they've lost their spouses, they've lost their children if their children have died before them, their friends are dying all around them, they're afraid of what the act of dying is, they feel that they can't face the uncertainty of life, and so they take matters into their own hands. And oftentimes in compacts with each other, husbands and wives or friends, elderly friends, commit suicide in their old age, usually by overdosing on pills is the common way. And again, it's if you notice the behavior patterns, reclusiveness, depression, intervene, ask questions, engage yourself with elderly people who can commit and do commit suicide, the most respectable people. You would never imagine that such good church-going Christians would commit suicide, but they do. And you can be there to help prevent them from taking their own lives. Okay, this is not a primer in suicide. I know that I dealt with suicide in the military for 30 years. These are just some highlights. There is a lot of material on the internet. If you have any issues with suicide, if you know of people who have issues with suicide, there's a lot of help out there in terms of educational material to inform you, to give you information, and to give you insight into what you need to do. But take it seriously. And lastly, but not leastly, is those who are around a person who has committed suicide. These people are not themselves automatically prone to suicide. That is the family, the friends, the relatives, the community. But they are people at risk. They have been traumatized by the death of their friend or their loved one or their family member. And that trauma can in turn, given, you know, in non-attention, can in turn, given non-attention, create especially among teenagers, it's very, very dangerous, especially among teenagers. The death of several teenagers in a row within a community that has that disease for the time being, that temporary insanity, can produce even additional suicides within that community because it's not it gets out of control. In other words, one person commit suicide, it leads another person leading suicide, and then there's a group suicide, and then the group suicide leads to other individuals, all of them connected by the links of friendship and the links of the exclusivity of their friendship, and oftentimes an exclusive group of people off among themselves, by themselves, over against and separate from and distinct from their peers. And that close kind of clique, if a suicide occurs or if several suicides occur within that clique, then there's a good possibility that those inside of that group can commit suicide themselves, having experienced the results of the others committing suicide. Very important to pay attention to that, because oftentimes we think, well, they know how horrible it was that their friends committed suicide, so now they're absolutely not going to commit suicide. Well, that can be true, but the reverse can also be true. Okay, a suicide, we dealt with that in dealing with the idea of you should not commit murder. That deals with you will not kill yourself as well. And I leave you with the thought that as a Christian, we believe that suicide is wrong. It is always wrong. It should never be even in your thoughts. And you should seek immediate medical attention if you consider suicide or know someone who considered suicide, because you're temporarily insane. And you may think of yourself as perfectly sane, but believe me, the thought of killing yourself and planning to kill yourself and having a plan and knowing how you would do it is evidence. Believe me when I say this. I hope anyone hearing my voice understands this. Is evidence that you are in a state of temporarily being out of your mind. And what you must seek is the appropriate medical attention. Okay, let's take a little pause here. We'll come back in a minute, and we'll wrap this up for today. We haven't finished the Ten Commandments, but I think we've dealt with some interesting topics. And I hope the last one on suicide, from my experience as a United States Army chaplain, is helpful to you. And if you need to look on further, there's plenty out there on the Internet about what to do in terms of helping people who might commit suicide. I'm Pastor Fred. Stay with us. Hello, this is Pastor Fred. I'm back. Thank you for listening in. We've had some great listening and some great conversation here. We're going to take the weekend off. As a matter of fact, I'll be traveling a little bit, but we'll be back. I'll try to put a few shows on here. We're going to pick up the Ten Commandments at commandment number seven, and as I said, we're looking at William Barclay's book. The Sixth Commandment goes on for quite some long time. I don't know whether I want to get into all of that, but you can get the book for yourself. Great book, by the way. I also have some other great books on here. I'd like to encourage you on those. And also, I'd like to ask you to do me a favor. I have a website other than this one, which is called Bible Study for Everyone. Bible Study for Everyone. Bible-study-for-everyone.com. Click on there. Take a look and see what we have there. There's a lot of great, I think it's great. I think there's some great material on there. And also, if you'd like to see a little bio about myself, who I am, what I've done, and what I look like, that type of thing. I wish I had more photos on there. I think I need to get a lot more photos on that website. I will. But BibleStudyForEveryone.com, great website. Please go to it, click on, and see some stuff there for yourself. You may find some helpful material on that website. And also, I have another ministry that I'm carrying out, or I'm trying to establish, which is called Christian Church Radio, ChristianChurchRadio.com. Now, Christian Church Radio is an internet radio station. And at this point, I just have not had the time to fully develop it, but it is on 24/7. It's a Christian Church Radio station. It's called Christian Church Radio. Christian Church Radio, one word, .com. You get there through a website. On the website, you when you get to ChristianChurchRadio.com, you see there, you know, listen in. You can listen to the Flash player. You can listen in through the MP3 player, which will download Winamp onto your computer, so you're forewarned. But it's a great program, Winamp, because, you know, you may not know it, but there are about 3,000, at least 3,000, internet radio stations on Shoutcast, which is a AOL product. And they're all free. They're all downloadable. You can listen to them. You don't have to download them as podcasts. There's a great amount of material out there through the internet radio system, which is not the broadcast system. It's the internet radio system. And I'm trying to establish, before we can no longer establish it, a Christian Church Radio Network. ChristianChurchRadio.com is the first step. Right now we play a lot of music, mostly classical. Sometimes we rebroadcast these broadcasts from this station onto that station. But right now it's 24/7 classical music. Oftentimes in the weekend we listen to Gregorian chant. You may not be very heavy into Gregorian chant, but it's one of the features that I have out there because of there's a very big lack of Gregorian chant on the internet. But internet radio, ChristianChurchRadio.com, click on there, go on to the website, click on MP3 player, go on to the thing, and listen, just, you know, each one of you who does that, it's registered just as a click on. And I would like to see if we can't get as many as 100 clicks in a day. That would be very exciting. Now, you don't have to spend hours and hours on the program, but if you go to it, ChristianChurchRadio.com, click on the MP3 player, go into that, listen to it. If you don't like what you hear, don't listen to it longer than a few minutes. Stay at a few minutes just to see what's going on. And then that click will give us an indication as we develop this program that there are fellow Christians and other interested people who will at least go that far. It's going to cost you nothing. I'm not going to send you any material. Can't trace you through the internet, so I don't know who you are, but you will be helping us if you're willing to do that for us. ChristianChurchRadio.com. And I'm Pastor Fred. You're listening to Perspectives on the Bible, Blog Talk Radio, and thank God for Blog Talk Radio. Wow. They say the best and easiest way to get your voice on the internet, absolutely. And if you have something you want to say, get your own Blog Talk Radio show. They give you 1/2 hour for free, 1/2 hour a day, 1/2 hour a day for free. And there's nothing more that you need than a computer, an internet, broadband internet connection, and a telephone. And you can do this. And if you have a free telephone through the internet, it's even better. So, and if you pay for it, well, you get Skype. Okay, I'm Pastor Fred. I want to thank you for listening. God bless you and keep you. God makes his face shine upon you and be gracious to you. God look upon you with his favor and give you peace. Amen. Thank you for listening. Have a good weekend.